This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 96-year-old Glenn Ferguson Jr., coming your way from the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego, where Glenn is involved in quite a few forward-looking initiatives, including a very unique award we're going to hear about shortly. But for now, we're looking back into the past, and specifically to World War II. After more than 3 years in the Marine Corps, he finally got to do what he'd always wanted to do.
I wound up flying about 20 different aircraft. We started out in the old biplanes, the old N2S, which is fabric covered, doped. The way we started it was to put a crank in and crank up the flywheel to get it going enough that the pilot could pull a pin on it and turn the engine. And that's how we got them started. First, I went to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It was just ground school. And then on our way up to Bunker Hill, we took a train. The day before that we arrived, they'd had a bad windstorm and the planes couldn't get back to the field. So all along, all those farmers' fields on the way on the alongside of the track, because people used to use what we called the iron beam, the railroad tracks, where our beam is place of the radio beam. Anyhow, they were obviously following the railroad tracks and would run out of gas, or they couldn't get to the field because of the weather. Because the weather in Indiana can really roll in and roll bad, so they were forced down. All along the line, there were the yellow perils nosed up in the fields. That's a good invitation to to people who are going to fly them.
People who don't know what you're talking about when you say yellow perils, that's what they called those fabric-covered biplanes.
Yeah, the N2S.
Yeah. So you were probably excited to graduate from that flimsy little thing.
Well, we graduated from there and went to outlying fields of Pensacola. Mm-hmm. And went through the rest of our flight training in an SNJ. The wheels fold up. It was actually used as a fighter plane in South America for a while. It was a big improvement over what we had been flying.
Was there a plane that you had seen, that you'd heard about, that you were really hoping to get a chance to fly?
Well, of course, everybody that went through flight training wanted to become a fighter pilot.
Sure.
But, you know, we had need for pilots and everything else. So many of us got assigned other things. When I graduated from Pensacola, I was assigned dive bombers. So I went to the field in Jacksonville to learn to dive bomb. There were dive bombers and torpedo bombers and transports, but the fighters and those that were going to fly float planes, anything of that nature, would stay there at Pensacola.
Did you have a favorite of those planes that you got to fly?
Well, people ask me that all the time, and I don't really have a favorite. But I did like the, later on I got into helicopters, and I liked the HO-5S. I could do anything in that thing, and oftentimes had to.
Well, I want to hear about that, but let's wrap up World War II first. So you're in a couple of years before America gets drawn into the war, and as it's nearing the end of the war, you're training to go over and fight the Japanese?
What happened is that we formed up a bunch of pilots to create a new dive bombing squadron. We went out through Miramar, which was at that point a shipping point, a collection point for people in the Western going out to the Pacific and so forth. Anyhow, they got us all together and put us aboard a destroyer transport, a destroyer that had been converted to ship troops in a hurry overseas. And we were all aboard that and went out to Eva. We formed the new squadron 343 at Eva, the dive bombing squadron. We were supposed to be in the first wave to bomb Japan, and of course, when they dropped the bombs, then they didn't need us to bomb Japan anymore. So they changed our orders to Tsingtao, China. And so that's how I wound up in North China.
And which dive bombers were you flying?
Well, at that time, it was the SB-2C. We had flown the SB-2C here in the States, but it was the Army model, the SB-2C-1A. And it was designed for the Army rockets. They didn't like it, so they gave it to the Marine Corps, naturally. And we flew it and overstressed it. And the pilot, two planes ahead of me in a rocket run, just shed his wings. Then a few days later, another pilot was in the landing pattern, ready to make a landing. And popped his flaps. It's all electrical. They had a big box behind the pilot seat with electrical contacts, and they would get corrosion is obviously what happened. But anyhow, he popped his flaps, and dive flaps on one side went up, and the landing flaps on the other side went down, put them in a snap roll. At 1,500 feet in a landing pattern, that's not the place to do a snap roll. Anyhow, he got it down, and we looked at his wings, and they had been pulled away from the fuselage. Why he didn't shed them, I don't know, but they'd been pulled away from the fuselage, and the general said, well, that's enough. But we still continued. I looked at my logbook, and it still shows the 1A. Anyhow, a few days later, I was up and popped my flaps, and it tried to snap me. But I was ready for it, over-controlled it, and it was able to keep my wings level. But I had to increase my speed in order to get more aileron control. So I had to land at 140 knots, which is pretty fast.
Ooh. Hope you had a long runway.
At El Toro. Thank goodness it was a long runway because I used it all.
I bet you did. And it sounds like you're saying the only reason you were ready for it is because you saw what had happened to the other pilot.
Well, we knew what could happen with those things.
And have you ever thought what would have happened to you if you had been part of that invasion force, if you're dive bombing these heavily defended Japanese targets?
You don't think of those things. If you're going to fly, you better be a fatalist. I had a friend who did think of things like that, and he had to quit. He quit and became a school teacher in Chicago. If you're a pilot, you're a fatalist. You know, you're going to get it, you're going to get it. That's just part of the game.
And you said something there. So Japan surrenders, and you get sent to China. And a lot of people aren't aware of what was still happening there.
Oh, it was really happening. Mao Tse-tung, well, to start with, Truman, he wasn't in the loop. FDR deliberately kept him out of the loop. He didn't know what was going on over in Asia. And so he sent Marshall over to investigate and see what was going on, who we should support, either Chiang Kai-shek or Mao. He came back. Mao had led him around by the nose and showed him everything that Mao wanted him to see. And so he came back and said, those people are nothing but poor agrarian farmers, and they were shooting at us up north. People don't realize that the Manchurian army didn't surrender at the Tokyo Bay. They surrendered in October to a Marine general at the racetrack, and I have a picture of it.
So over there as a dive bomber pilot, what were you guys doing until that Manchurian army surrendered in October of 45?
Well, right at the beginning, Mao started showing his teeth and was doing a lot of things, taking over provinces and so forth. And so they decided to have a show of force over Peiping. Had our planes also joined, it was a big show of force because there were a lot of squadrons that were assigned over there, but then the dive bombing squadrons that were there in Tsingtao. So they sent our bombing squadrons over there to join the force. Luckily, I wasn't assigned that day, but the flight leader was taking the flight back home. And because of the lack of instrument training, he rightfully decided to fly under the clouds. But he got into a valley, and the clouds trapped him against the mountains, so he had to climb through them. And in climbing through them, he wiped off the bottom half of the squadron on the mountaintop. Then the TBM squadron was flying the railroad patrol. They had lost three men, so we had a mass burial a little later on. We had 10 men in the burial. You had to have an officer sign off. There was a body in the casket, so I was the officer that was assigned to that, and I saw the remains of our pilots. They were like a sandbag stuffed full of sand, a big sandbag. No arms, no legs, no heads. That was what they looked like, you know, sand in a sandbag. Anyhow, then we had to go down to Okinawa to pick up some new planes to replace those that we lost. But on our patrols, we got shot at once in a while. But the northern patrols got shot at every day. The Mao Tse-tung patrols were really active. And one of the men who was in my squadron that had bailed out of the plane before they hit the mountains, he never flew again. It scared him so bad. But he said he went belly to belly with the plane. Now, how you do that, I don't know. But anyhow, That scared him so badly, he never flew again.
Well, and I heard you when you said that, you know, to be a pilot, you had to be a fatalist. Either you were going to get it or you didn't. But I'm sure the reality was when that all came to an end, and those guys you just described who died after the Japanese surrender, they're counted among the 406,000 Americans who were killed during those 4 years of World War II. I'm sure there were some guys that you knew that
lost
their lives
in the war. Oh, yeah, I
knew
them all, yeah.
Knowing all those men who paid that price, who didn't get to come home from the war, who didn't get to go on and have families the way you did, and here you are almost 97 years old, still going strong. When you think about those guys, what should we remember?
Well, they were Marines. They did their job. They paid for it. That's what you have to expect if you join the Marine Corps, that you may or may not come home. It depends upon the circumstances and your luck. Those men weren't the first ones that I had lost, friends that I had lost. When I was in the bombing school, about the second flight, back in the old days, the SBD, the first model, had a long telescope as a sight. And the problem with that was that if you looked through that scope, you had a tendency to look at it too long to pick up your targets. People don't realize that you would go into the target, say at 10 or 12,000 feet. You'd peel off and dive into the target, hopefully downwind, and the wind would tend to push you off the target. But one way or another, you were subject to all the crosswinds, all the varieties of directions that the wind could sometimes pull on you. So you were constantly corkscrewing around fighting to stay on target. If you were looking through that scope, you got what we call target fixation. And that's what happened to Jimmy. Apparently he got target fixation. He missed the center point, the crosshairs, by 8 feet. He just dove right straight in. That was the first friend that I lost that way. And I lost others due to different problems, night flying and that sort of thing.
Was that hard to handle as a young man?
No, once again, that was just part of the game.
And you never thought that could be me?
Well, the one time that I reacted in that way was when I crashed a fighter plane at El Toro. I was upside down, gas dripping into my face, and I couldn't get out. I had to have the crash crew man help me. I couldn't get my right parachute strap unbuckled.
Was so this when you were a test pilot after World War II?
No, that was when I was in a fighter plane, F4U fighter plane.
Oh, you're flying a Corsair?
Yeah.
Still
we,
training during the war?
We went off on a what we called a group. The whole group took off. Hmm. That takes a lot of planes, a lot of time to get airborne and then get them back. So I was in the middle of the flight, and I was left-hand. We were landing at El Toro, four planes abreast, which is, you don't usually do that.
Right.
You know, because if one plane crashes, you might get the rest of them. So anyhow, we were landing four abreast in order to get everybody back in time, because I was on the left-hand side of the left flight. When I landed, the wind tilted my wing, because I was getting a burble from the wind coming from my right, which tilted, and I was getting everybody else's prop wash. That kind of tilted me up a little bit, and a contractor left a big pile of dirt on the left-hand side of the left runway, and my wing ticked it. Well, that's all it took to spin me off the runway, and I went tooling across the boondocks, and there was a big ditch. It was big enough that they said I actually got airborne. Anyhow, the nose dug in, and I flipped over. Like I said, I had to have the crash crew help me get out.
So you ended up upside down in a ditch with gas dripping out?
Yeah. Normally they catch fire.
Yeah.
And but it didn't in this case. I had a buddy do a similar incident later on. He caught fire. But anyhow, my wife wasn't there at that time. I had just come back from a school and had her in Washington, D.C. with her folks and my two boys, and she had flown out back out. We were going to a squadron party, and so I stopped her outside the house and told her that I had crashed a plane. But, you know, it's 2 weeks ago. I had flown a lot since then, so there was nothing for her to worry about. That was the only time that I have reacted to. You know, I've had all sorts of things. I've blown up engines and had all sorts of forced landings and that sort of thing. But if you fly, you can't worry about flying, not be a good pilot.
But that one got to you because you thought of your wife and your two boys?
Well, it didn't get to me. It was a matter that I thought I'd better say something about it for fear that they would say something at the party.
You wanted her to hear it from you.
Yeah.
And after World War II, before you became a pioneering helicopter pilot, you were a test pilot for some other Marine Corps planes, is that right?
Well, they normally would assign a pilot as a test pilot in the different squadrons, and all that really meant was that you were the guy that was suckered in, and you had to take a plane whenever they did heavy maintenance, then you were the one that had to go up and fly an hour over the field in case you lost an engine. And so I was a test pilot in that sense, but I was later assigned as a field service test pilot at Patuxent on the HOK before we got the HOK. So I was a test pilot in that sense, but not a test pilot that was permanently assigned like you find pilots in the Air Force at Edwards or the Navy comparable spot is Patuxent, Maryland, where they send the new planes for testing.
Well, and here at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum, you can see a lot of different iterations of helicopters. But you were flying some of the earliest models. How far a cry is that from what we know today?
We have what we call the barn over here where we have other aircraft other than what you see displayed. And there's a Bell and an HOK over there. That goes back to the Marine Corps really got started in helicopters in 1947 when General Hubbard was sent out to remember the big atomic bomb test that they had out in the Pacific. Bikini. Where they had all the ships anchored,
yeah.
And then they blew up the bombs to see what damage it did to the different. Well, he went out and he saw that, and he knew instantly that we could no longer land Marines the way that we used to. We couldn't form them up and congregate them into a big force to make a landing such as we'd done before with the ships close by and that sort of thing. They had to be dispersed. And so in order to be dispersed and get the Marines back together again, we had to have a different method of doing that. And so at that time, they were aware of the helicopters. And that's when they formed HMX as an experimental squadron. And they sent five HO5Ss to HMX to take part in an exercise where they would take the Marines from ship to shore to prove out what they eventually developed into what we call the vertical envelopment. Anyhow, that proved valid enough that in 1947 was really the start of our vertical development concept. The problem was we didn't have the planes nor the pilots in those days. So we had to develop all of that, which took time. And by that time, the Korean War came along. There were two concepts that were developed at the same time. One was the prompt evacuation of the casualties, and the second was the vertical envelopment, which is what everybody was interested in. So when the Korean War came along, they sent 161 out there to create the vertical envelopment. We called them our rich cousins because they got all the supplies and we got nothing. In VMO, which is where I was with the squadrons that picked up the wounded in the Bell helicopter.
Is it true that some of the early helicopters that you flew were held together by bungee cords?
Well, the allusion to that has to do with the HO5S. Control forces in the HO5S are so great that when you first tried to fly the plane, you didn't have enough muscle. And so you had to learn how to get your body twisted around or you could push your arm into it to get control of the stick. And in order to help you, they put bungee cords down below on the bottom of the stick that were attached to a motor, and you had a thumb button in the top of the stick that would control the motor in one of four motors, whatever direction you wanted to pull it. The problem was that they would always, after a couple of days, stretch those bungee cords to where they weren't doing any good. Like I had a fella in my class who was small. He carried a cushion with him in order to push himself further forward to get more control on the stick. That's where the bungee cord came from.
It's break time again, but when we come back with 96-year-old Glenn Ferguson, the dangerous but life-saving duty he had during the Korean War, yet another president with whom he served closely, and the unique award he helped launch at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.